Good morning. Welcome to the last day of the conference. It's great to see you here all bright and early. So this is Site Reliability Engineering Team Life Cycles. This is a talk that I hope will give you an insight into how to seed and grow SRE principled approach in your organization. I'm not going to sit here and tell you how to do the SRE role so much as talk about how you will approach doing SRE in an organization and making that SRE team actually useful to that organization. So first of all, I need to introduce myself, give you a little bit of context where this talk is coming from. I am Stephen Thorne. I'm a site reliability engineer. I've worked in both ads and cloud at Google, and I've been responsible for operating and improving the reliability of very large systems. My new team, Customer Reliability Engineering, which is still an SRE team, is approaching our cloud customers and helping us understand their products and integrate our practices with theirs to help them run reliable systems on our platform. And finally, the Site Reliability Workbook, the new book that came out last month, was a labor of love for me, collecting and trying to distill the wisdom that we've grown inside Google and also what we've learned from industry and putting it down on paper, trying to give you an idea of how to implement SRE in your organization. And that's where I'm drawing a lot of the information from this talk as well. So what do we actually want from site reliability engineering? Google has found that site reliability engineering has been a very successful model for operating applications in production without getting overwhelmed. We found it addresses the long-term costs of running software and tries to bring this alignment between developers and operations and provides a framework which we use to run systems at scale. So we believe it's a versatile model that can be used to run mission-critical systems if they're large, small, huge, very fast-growing. But that's just words. Like, how do you actually implement that, and how do you actually present that as a value proposition to your organization? So first of all, I think you already do site reliability engineering. Let's just get that out of the way first. I really believe that you are already doing SRE. What I'm trying to do is trying to give you some tools for you to be able to make that SRE approach more practical and more valuable to your organization rather than teaching you how to do your own role. You've heard of this conference, you've read about it, you've implemented all the things I list here. Blameless postmortems, incident response, monitoring and alerting, capacity management. These are all SRE things, and you should continue doing them. I'm not saying don't do them. I'm trying to give you some of the tools and some of the basis for how to get your organization on side with you as well. I've spoken to folks at organizations who come to me and say, we want to start doing SRE. How do we do that? So what we've done is worked on a set of principles that codify the core of how to make an SRE function in a business actually make sense, and to try and achieve that alignment between dev and operations that we claim it provides. So just to give you a random example here, blameless postmortems, hugely valuable, but they're not actually going to cause an alignment between dev and operations. They're just a way of blaming people without actually saying you're blaming people. If you watch the talk on Wednesday morning, I laughed all the way through that talk. So what I want to do is give you a broad set of directions that will help you unleash the potential of SRE in your org. And we call this the SRE team lifecycle because it starts with a small set of principles and scales to as large as I've seen. And these are those principles. I don't want to leave you in suspense here. Site reliability engineering needs service level objectives with consequences. Site reliability engineers have time to make tomorrow better than today. And site reliability engineering teams have the ability to regulate their workload. So I'm going to address these one by one, and you'll notice that the subject of these principles changes with each subsequent item. As your application of SRE principles goes through its life cycle from inception to large-scale deployment. If you just implement principle one, that's fantastic, and you don't even need an SRE in your org to do that. And as you implement the principle two, that's how you actually get your engineers to be productive. And then principle three here is about how to make an SRE team a useful unit within an org. But you don't actually have to go all the way through just to implement SRE. You can do SRE without even having an SRE. First, we're going to talk about this alignment of incentives. Service-level objectives. I believe they're fundamental to SRE practices, and I'm going to briefly introduce them, just because there are people in the room who haven't seen them introduced before, but also because my terminology differs to other people's terminology, and I want you to understand where I'm coming from here. We're only going to touch on some of these concepts, and if you want to know a whole lot more, there are some excellent books, blog articles, other talks at this conference about that. So SLOs define, service-level objectives, define a goal for reliability that we believe an application needs to achieve to meet the needs of its users and the business. We measure how well the application is performing and aim to keep it at or above that level of reliability. There's an ideal to defining an SLO that I apply, that if the customers are generally happy with my application's reliability, then the SLO should be being met. And so here are some typical SLOs, paraphrased as, your site is up enough. Your HTTP server responds with success often enough, fast enough. Your logs processor processes enough log entries fast enough. Defining a good SLO means picking goals for measures that track your customers' actual experience. Ideally, you want to set goals on things your customers really care about. You never want to set an SLO on CPU usage because your customers never actually see how hot your CPUs get, but they do see how an overloaded server slows them down. That's the distinction we want to draw here. So SLOs can get very complex, especially when they start to involve actual user expectations. You click a button, and then 10 minutes later, something happens. Trying to get some kind of metric which matches their expectations is quite hard to do in detail. These are just simple examples. I'm sure you can appreciate that it can get actually quite difficult. But of course, start with something simple. Always start with a simple. Otherwise, you're just going to spend up polishing something that you never get out the door. So I believe SLOs are your best alerting metric. This is actually one of the value propositions of SLOs, that if they're good SLOs, then being out of SLO means your customers are getting unhappy, and it's time for whoever's holding the pager to spring into action. Time to be a hero. But that's not where the story ends. And in fact, it's just the start, and we're not really going to talk about this at all, because we're actually concerned with how the organization responds to unreliability, not the SRE. So every time I talk about SLOs, it evokes this conversation about SLAs. In my view and definition, SLAs are legal agreements between organizations with penalties for not meeting them, typically financial. I try to defend my reliability at the point where the customers start to get unhappy using the best quality metrics that I can possibly come up with. This is the point well before the SLA, where they're eligible to get their money back. So SLAs have their place, but they're not feeding into our SRE principle here. But if you remember what that principle said, it was site reliability engineering needs SLOs with consequences. So much like an SLA, SLOs need to have consequences. Otherwise, they're not going to have any useful impact. They're going to be amazing alerting metrics, but that's where it stops. It doesn't bring any of that alignment. It doesn't bring any of that coordination with another group. And so I strongly advocate, while using SLOs as a way for your on-call engineers to get alerted, we need to actually look at how it impacts your business in the longer term. And that's where error budget policy comes in. So much like an SLA has financial consequences, SLOs have their own consequences. And our way of achieving that isn't by instituting any kind of penalty, like, oh, your SLO was violated, you lose half of a headcount for the rest of the year, or you lose privileges at the staff canteen. That would be nonsense. We implement an error budget policy, and the purpose of an error budget policy is to try and actually improve the reliability of the system. If you ask somebody how reliable they want to be, their gut reaction is always to ask for more. Start at 100% reliability and treat any failure to meet it as an emergency. But in truth, we know that the only reliable system is one that does nothing at all and can never change. So part of site reliability engineering is establishing what an acceptable level of failure is and balancing that against other aspects of your business. This lets you move fast when things are good and respond to failure appropriately when it happens. And to implement this, we use a budget for failure. You can trivially see that if your goal is 100%, you're always in one mode. If your goal is 100%, you're never going to meet it, so you're always having to deal with the fact you're unreliable. So we introduce this error budget. So my definition of an error budget is the difference between 100% reliability, that unattainable level of reliability, and the SLO for our application. So as measured over a reasonably long window, such as a month. While we remain within budget, we're more reliable than our goals, and when we run out of our budget, we need to take steps. This automatically brings you into a new operating mode. So when you're in SLO, you move fast, and it's actually the goal of the SRE org when you're within SLO to reduce friction and allow the organization to take risks. So I present a simple example here. An uptime SLO of 99.9% means being down for 0.1% of the month is okay. We all know that 0.1% of a month is 43 minutes. So after a 20-minute outage, you have another 23 minutes of downtime budget to spend over that period. And you can spend that doing releases, doing whatever. That 20-minute outage shouldn't evoke any organizational response. Organizational response, of course, SRE response. You're gonna be responding to the incident, you're responding in a tactical fashion, but this isn't something where you have to sort of have a meeting with your VP about the fact your system was too unreliable this month because you had this 20-minute downtime. It's within error budget. It's fine. We agreed to this. So what do you do when you actually spend your whole budget? This is when you go into the second operating mode. The operating mode of 100% reliability and any failure is tragic. Instead, we only do that when we go out of error budget. It means you didn't meet your reliability objectives over your reporting period window. And something needs to change because otherwise your users will get more grumpy. We know that when we're out of SLO, our users get grumpy. So when we're out of error budget, that's when we think they're starting to get grumpy. So this isn't an SLA, and the response isn't to say sorry or write a refund check. It's to do something to make your system more reliable. And this isn't punishment. This is something that you need to do strategically as an organization. Your short-term goal is to acknowledge you have a problem, stop the problem from getting worse, and long-term, to make sure the same thing doesn't happen again. So when you have a big outage, it's a huge emotional issue. Everyone's running on adrenaline. You feel like it's the biggest outage you've ever faced. But it's okay. You already agreed in a non-emotional and calm way a few months ago that when you run out of error budget, in partnership with your dev team and the folks running production, and your product management, and your executives, what steps to take if it ever got this far? So that's your error budget policy. The error budget is just maths. The policy is actually where it hits the organization. And there are many possible error budget policies. The one that suits your business is probably very specific to what will materially help your application improve its reliability and what you can get agreement from your stakeholders. It's a policy. So it's something that needs to be supported from the very highest level of your organization. It doesn't matter if you and the guy sitting next to you or the woman sitting next to you sit down and make up a policy and write it down and put it in your wiki unless you actually have agreement to it. So that's step one. In a specific example on a team I was on, we found the biggest cause of instability was pushing new versions of the code. Because too many systems were being rolled out at once, a failure in any one of them caused them all to suffer. We had to roll everyone back at the same time. It was slowing down development velocity. And in the meantime, our customers were facing performance degradation and errors. So the error budget policy that we were using at the time was to introduce a push freeze. And during that freeze, we worked with our developers to partner and decouple the releases. This would result in a freeze, everybody working on this problem, we'd start releasing again, we'd have more problems, we froze again. And it was this situation where we were able to align the incentives and get our devs and our SREs to actually work on the thing properly. And now all of these components are decoupled, any of them we can rolled back quite safely without damaging the whole development process. And this is the whole idea of being able to align your incentives so your devs actually get something more reliable at the end of the day. So that's not the only error budget policy. I mean, it's the one that we mentioned in the first SRE book. It's the one that we use across Google a lot. And one of the reasons for that is our own analysis of our own stuff says that 70% of our outages come from configuration or binary changes. But that's Google statistics, and the stats in your organization might be vastly different. I see orgs that have such an amazing QA department that fewer than 1% of their releases cause any problems or have to be rolled back. And I think that's just fantastic for them. So they need something else. So I've seen other examples, such as when you have an error budget overage, sprint planning must pull action items from the backlog, post-mortem action items from the backlog, or software development team must meet with the SRE team daily to outline their improvements. The idea here is to get some agreement about what to do when you're out of error budget and you have to do something which will materially improve the reliability of your system. And so that's our first principle. Site reliability engineering needs service level objectives with consequences. And you can do this in your organization, and it doesn't matter if your whole SRE organization in your company is one-third of one product manager, or half a software engineer, or a quarter of a sysadmin. You can implement this policy just by agreeing on an error budget policy and getting some monitoring in place. It doesn't need somebody job titled at SRE in order to achieve this. So the key points are: measure your reliability, hold yourselves accountable, and act on it when it's overrunning your budget. It's fundamental, and the rest of SRE can build on top of this. And we think you should benefit as a result. Now, proceed to the next stage of our life cycle. So that was sort of the inception phase. This is the basis. And you might be able to implement this in your SRE organization today, in your organization today without an SRE team. You might have already done that. It's fine. So the next stage of our life cycle, making tomorrow better than today. This is where we start talking about how to help folks in SRE, in the SRE role, achieve reliability. This is how you can succeed in enabling your site reliability engineers to follow the model of SRE. What are you going to do? You've got some site reliability engineers. What do you get them to do? We believe that SREs must have real responsibility, meaning that most must both be engaged with operating the system, but also empowered to do something about it when it goes wrong. So what will you as an SRE or your SREs work on? The first one is defining and refining the service level objectives. Often, even if you have them, they're not any good, and even if you think they're good, they can always be improved. I think the first thing you should do in any post-mortem is look at and say, what SLOs were impacted? And if they weren't, why weren't they? And if they were, is that actually damaging the customer experience? And you should be refining these. Your site reliability engineers will typically actually be your experts on this, and also the expert on running the system in production and can bring some alignment there to the monitoring and for tuning and refining SLOs. Your site reliability engineers, you as site reliability engineers, are the best placed person to see that the error budget policy is enacted when necessary, giving guidance and reminding folks of that agreement that they made. They need to make sure that the application is actually meeting the reliability of the expectation of its users. You are responsible directly to the users as a site reliability engineer. The users of the system need the system to be up for it to work, and so that's where you need to be thinking. But I also think that SRE needs to be doing some toil on the system. It's a major part of operating systems in production, and if it's not part of the role, then you're not touching production quite often enough. But it doesn't mean you have to be toiling every day. Not toiling the whole day, running kubectl over and over, reinstalling systems, upgrading base images. It must be a bounded part of the role. Because if you're an SRE, and you don't have anything apart from time for toil, you're really just being consigned to doing ops over and over and over. It's almost an entirely ops role, and you're not actually able to apply any of the S3 principles. So the idea here is that we want to put a bound on that toil. We typically say 50%, but that's just an arbitrary number, meaning if it seems too high, drive it down, and if it seems too low, drive it up. So apart from toil, you should be doing project work, and I think this is the most important piece. As an SRE, you need to be able to accomplish project work, not just do it, with a focus on making things better for yourself as an SRE, whatever better might be. Better in your organization, that depends entirely on what your concerns are and what your needs are. So I think the first thing you should look at is things that are impacting or might impact the SLO. Those risks that you've identified and you think, well, we could do something about that one cable being the single point of failure for the entire data center. And secondly, anything that is simply causing you toil. These are the two most important projects which you should think about picking up. By giving SREs the time for and the ability to do project work, they can accomplish more because they have the mandate to dig themselves out of whatever hole you're in and enable to go ahead and actually get that done. As an SRE myself, I'm in constant fear of operational overload. This is a well-founded fear. If it happens, then work will compound, and all I'm doing every day is toil, and then I'm not able to do any projects, and then I'm not able to drive down that toil. You end up doing nothing but ops and keeping the system running. So, in your organization and in the SRE lifecycle, you have to have acknowledgement from your management, from the other departments, from your other stakeholders, that if your SRE team is doing too much toil, you've got to be able to do something about it. Add me more resources, get project work done in other parts of the organization, which will drive down this toil. And if you can't get that agreement, you need to sort of go back and say, have the SREs been given too many things to do? Is there anything we can do to reduce this? You've got to be able to have that alignment in your organization. So your organization needs to acknowledge that SRE is not just ops and pay attention to what projects they're working on and what they're delivering on. And so here is our second principle. Site reliability engineers have time to make tomorrow better than today. And you can see how we do it, by capping the effort on ops and providing the space to do project work. And I think any org with either one or thousands of SREs needs to apply this principle in order to enable SREs to both run the system and address its reliability at the same time. Your leaders and stakeholders need to acknowledge and understand that SRE is not just an ops team and should pay attention to and foster an environment where project work is not just encouraged but supported and work together to drive down this toil if it's overloading the team. So we're talking about SRE team life cycles, and that leads into our third principle. A typical way of implementing this is by having an SRE team be a different part of your organization, a team responsible for running mission-critical software in production and keeping it reliable. And I'm talking about that model, but I acknowledge there are many other models of doing this. There are SREs who are embedded in their dev teams. They might report to the same managers. So please see this as an example, not an explicit way. Oh, you should go back and redo your org chart to match what Google thinks things should be. Not being prescriptive here. So I don't think you can create a site reliability engineering team by taking an existing team and changing the name on the door. I actually had a conversation with somebody just recently, and they said, okay, so we've hired 200 SREs, but now, what do SRE do? I really want to know how you can find 200 SREs. Your SRE team lifecycle will work but better if you start with SLOs, build up some principled approaches to engineering to those SLOs, and prioritize giving the most mission-critical systems to the SRE team to own in production. Now, note that I say mission critical, and giving. This means that there's plenty of room for other teams to run things. And SRE don't implicitly have the only keys to your prod infrastructure. As an SRE, you're there to force multiply. I changed the font size on my display and then I just lost my place entirely. As an SRE, you're there to force multiply, not to gatekeep. So this means that you should be able to share your responsibilities with other parts of your organization. By sharing the responsibility of running your application in production with some other products which are either partially or entirely owned by your dev or DevOps orgs, maybe without even an anticipation of SRE taking them on, you can get much better synergy between teams. Now, I do acknowledge some folks only have like the one application in production and things like this, but when you have many, many microservices, there's this tendency and there's this this impulse to say, oh, well, we're launching to production tomorrow. Let's tell SRE about it. That's a little too late, isn't it? So by having a shared operation model where you say, okay, devs, you can actually deploy things to production, but if they're mission critical, then SRE will consider taking them on. That's a much better way of sharing responsibility and sharing the fate of your organization and sharing the shade of the reliability of the system. And that's how you get some better synergy between your teams. Sometimes the role of an SRE team in an organization might actually be to try and make it so easy for your devs to launch things to production without talking to SRE that that's actually a wonderful thing for the SRE team to be doing. And then they pay attention to the SLOs of the system as a whole and maybe respond tactically to the hotspots and let everything else run. That's a perfectly reasonable way of running an SRE team because it's based on our first principle. You have an SLO, you have consequences, and you have your SREs doing project work to drive down their toil. Perfectly reasonable way of doing things. And that's a perfectly reasonable SRE team lifecycle. So we see SRE as a team that needs to be able to do a good job of dealing with the most important pieces first. And as that team grows, we'll take responsibility, perhaps, for more and more production services. And to be clear here, if you're getting overloaded with toil, stop taking things on. And you need agreement from your organization that that's something that's allowable to happen. So in order to be able to continue to do a good job to make tomorrow better than today and to engineer to SLO, there needs to be a way that your team can push back when that load becomes too much to handle. So we apply that pressure many different ways to try and regulate this workload. And it might be that a system is so complicated that no one can operate it without knowing it inside and out. So if that's the case, and nobody can possibly operate this without knowing it inside and out, one of my examples here is, well, we got paged again for error message -1, the only page we ever get for this system. And so we have to escalate to the dev in order to figure it out. So the most appropriate SRE thing to do here is to put the person who can fix it on the pager. Done. Solved. SRE team toil reduced. The system is made more reliable because the person who can fix it is notified sooner. It's paying attention to your SLO as well. It's perfectly reasonable in my opinion. So I have a framework that I like to apply when thinking about what systems are the most appropriate for an SRE team to take on. This is the sort of thing where you say, okay, I've got 100 microservices, I've got 3 SREs, what's the most impactful thing that they can do? This framework comes from the 3 principles. How mission critical is it? The more mission critical, the more important that it might be for an SRE team to take it on, but it's not the only axis. Second one is how operable is it? How much can they actually do when it pages? Will they be able to add more resources? Will they be able to debug it? Will they be able to find out what the problem is and resolve it without escalating? That's how operable it is. It might be, you're in 3 data centers and 1 data center has a blip. You remove the traffic from that data center at the load balancer, you're fine. Or it might be it's a singly homed application running a piece of software and the only thing you can ever do is reboot it. There's a big spectrum there. And then there's how mutable it is. How much are your SREs going to be able to affect it in the long term? Meaning, okay, so it was unreliable today, there was that problem, there's that procedure we do when that problem occurs. you know, reboot the system. And we're not allowed to touch the source code, we're not allowed to see how it works, and we're locked off from the logs. And we're definitely not allowed to write any commits or update the monitoring. It's not a very sort of easy to change system. It's not a sort of system that you can defend the reliability of long term. When you enact the error budget policy, your SREs will say, well, error budget policy is enacted. There's nothing we can do, though. So it's not very mutable. So when you have, when you're picking what applications an SRE team will be most effective dealing with, they want to be mission critical enough that the company wants to invest. They need to be operable enough that the SRE team will be able to do the toil part of their job and be able to respond to things when things go wrong. And then in the mutable bucket, that's our project work. That's how we're going to be able to affect the reliability of these things long term. Of course, there is a combination of these things, and there are different qualifications to these. And it might be that, well, it's not very mutable, but it's mutable enough, and it's super mission critical, so you do it anyway. So let's talk about leadership buy-in. And I believe it's required for every aspect of SRE. It's required for our error budget policy, for our cap on toil, and especially important for shared responsibility. If your leadership doesn't back up your error budget policy, you need to go all the way back to principle one and fix that, potentially again. When your applications miss their SLOs, it puts a large amount of additional load on the SRE team, who by necessity has to spend much of their time fighting fires and will accrue more tasks to do to improve the system. So your leadership is the best placed part of your organization to help here, either by funding the focus on reliability or, and this is important, by agreeing to a loosening of the SLO. We should all acknowledge that sometimes it's okay to loosen the SLO. I have seen an SRE team literally fall apart and be disbanded because the application was constantly out of SLO and the development team refused to commit to addressing the problem. If the pager is off going, if the pager is going off too often, can't you just hire more people to answer the pager? Said the management of that team. But we believe the correct thing to do is freeze the pushes, refocus development on fixing things identified in postmortems, and improve the health of the application. But that never actually got resolved. There was no leadership buy-in there. And fortunately, the SRE team leadership applied this principle and said, no, enough is enough. SRE will work where they can provide more value. And we gave the operation of that service back to the developers. So I totally acknowledge that's not for everybody. The idea of being able to hand software back to the developers is something that won't work for every organization. But for other organizations, it's perfectly viable. But you should be able to do something to put back pressure on. And that needs leadership buy-in. You need to be able to convince your leadership that in order to do reliable system stuff, you need to share your responsibility with your developers. No just throwing over the wall. That's not going to align any incentives. So I don't have to tell you that fixing issues after release is always more expensive than doing it right in the first place. This is another place where SRE teams can provide value, especially when things are stable and looking well. Like if you're always within SLO and you don't have much toil and the project work is all right, this is the point at which you can go and get ahead of yourself. By consulting on designs before the product launch, you've got all those lessons you learned from making things reliable on the other systems, and you can try and apply those before they become much more expensive with the new systems that are being launched. In a shared responsibility model world, being able to consult on designs, and this is important, and this is where the alignment of incentives comes in, SRE should be able to consult on the design and block the launch until vital concerns have been dealt with. And that can reduce your SRE toil in the long run. Now, I'm sure you can all appreciate that good automation can benefit the running of systems production. Now, I should stress here that not every SRE is a software developer. Not every SRE is an expert on automation. Your company should be addressing automation where it helps drive down toil and prioritize aggressively on things that are causing toil. It might be that the SRE project work you do is implementing this toil, or you might be getting your devs to do it. And this is also where the shared responsibility comes in. And this is how you will, and a benefit to the organization here is this is how you will get your SRE org to be responsible for more and more services, yet not suffer from operational overload. And this is how you can scale up your SRE team non-linearly with the number of services they support. The more things become alike because they've all been reviewed and they're all using the same technology stack, and the more automation you have in place allows you to maintain more systems without actually having more SREs. So a mature SRE team can support many more services than a new one because they've spent the time to make things similar and automated. And that's our last principle. SRE teams have the ability to regulate their workload. And once you have your team up and running, this is the principle you should apply to allow for growth and harmony while scaling up your operations as you grow, add more services, and develop even larger systems. In summary, we've published one book on the subject of SRE. Two books on the topic of SRE, the Site Reliability Engineering book, Niall Murphy, Jen Petoff are here at the conference, and then the Site Reliability Workbook we published last month. This has a lot of this knowledge in it, and in fact, this talk is based on, I think, chapter 19. And this provides you a much more detailed guide how you actually implement SRE practices in your org. And here are our principles, restated again. Site reliability engineering needs service level objectives with consequences. And I believe you can do this in any organization. Site reliability engineers have time to make tomorrow better than today. And even you as the very first SRE in an organization needs to be able to do this. You need to have things that you are doing working on production and then things you are doing to make sure you don't have to do those things again. And then site reliability engineering teams have the ability to regulate their workload so that your teams can flourish and grow. Thank you. Now, one of the great pleasures with giving this talk is I know that there are a lot of people in the audience who have questions about how to do this, and so I'd like to actually give you a few moments to ask some questions. David Blank Edelman, everyone.
Great. So, I hear these talks again and again about, that include these caveats, but this may not work in your organization, or this will work in your organization, that sort of stuff. And I would really love to see a method to determine whether these things will work in an organization that does not involve trying it and failing it. I'm not exactly talking about what you do when you say stress test a bank, but I am, kind of. And so I'm just curious if your group has seen methods for determining how well and how much friction there will be to these sort of things without actually doing them and failing?
So that's a great question. In fact, the thing that will work or won't work for your organization, the moment that I find out that it won't work is actually very early. It's when you mention it to a product manager or a C-level exec and they say, that could never work here. And their prediction of doom is often totally accurate because they're the person who will cause it to fail. And that's where the leadership buy-in thing comes in. You need to be able to get them on side and make them enthusiastic about it. And these folks who say, you should do this, you should align these incentives, you should give them time to do the toil, and the project work to drive down that toil, if they're on your side, then that's our recipe for success. And the failure happens in the first 30 seconds, in my experience thus far.
Talk about error budgets. For example, you've got like 43 minutes of downtime in a month. On the second day of the month, I've got an outage and 1 hour down. So does it mean that I should not have any error to the rest of the month? How do I manage this error budget over time?
Excellent question. So my experience here has been that error budgets are either great over a much longer period, so like a quarter or a half year, if you're going to go on a quarterly or a half year reporting period and that actually matters to you. But if you're going to go anything shorter than that, you should do on a rolling period. The other example here is what happens if you have a major outage on the 31st of the month? Does that mean that on the 1st of the month you don't have to worry about that? I assure you, your customers remember yesterday. So I advocate a rolling 30 days and a burn down. And in fact, in the site reliability workbook, we've got some great maths and the worked examples in Prometheus syntax for how to actually measure how quickly you're burning that error budget. Because you can easily understand that if it's a slope and it's going to cross the line in a week, you should file a ticket. And if it's a slope which is sort of almost vertical going towards the axis, then you need to act immediately. And so that's sort of how you respond to that tactically. And then the idea is to try and keep it above that line as much as possible. Ideally, you sort of dip below, and then in a couple of days, you've got error budget again because you're using a rolling window. And if things go badly, you might freeze for a couple of weeks just so that your customers don't experience any more pain.
I like the idea to give payers to developers. But how do you handle production access taking into account compliance?
Production access and compliance. So I understand with compliance, there's a whole lot of stuff like the person who writes the code shouldn't push to production in some regulatory frameworks and things like that. SRE can work entirely in tandem with a traditional ops team or with your DevOps engineers who are qualified to do this and everything. SRE doesn't mean the people who push to production. I think that's something that we need to acknowledge, and I'm trying to emphasize here, that when you're sharing the responsibility for production with the rest of the org, it means that SRE should be concentrating on the mission-critical systems, the SLO compliance, all of this, but they're not the gatekeepers for everyone. In your organization, you might have traditional ops people, or you might simply consign a number of your SREs to a traditional ops role. But that's sort of tangential to the SRE principles. That's just how you're implementing things in your org.
But would you give access to production to developers?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. If there wasn't a compliance reason not to, sure.
Okay.
With the usual caveat that if you can't trust them, you take the access away and try and sort of talk to your leadership about how good practices should be done, right? Yeah.
So you talk about establishing upfront SLOs with consequences and that the consequences should improve the state of things, right? And that this is all done in advance. How do you know, you don't always know what consequence will actually improve things. So if, let's say you decide in advance, we're gonna lock feature launches if we're out of SLO, and it turns out that we went out of SLO because of some completely unrelated reasoning. So how do you reconcile this, needing to do this in advance when we're not in a state of emergency, with the fact that you don't always know what circumstances are actually gonna take you out of SLO?
Okay, so I'm gonna respond to this with some of my own experience. I have seen situations where totally out of the blue disasters that we had no perception of how they could happen in the first place happened, had nothing to do with a push. And the thing we did when we ran out of error budget because of that disaster was freeze the pushes, because we knew that pushes also contributed to unreliability. And that was the easiest way for us to start clawing back error budget at the fastest rate possible and increasing the confidence of our users in our system while we fixed all of those things. So, of course, when you have a postmortem, you have action items, you action those action items. That's something that we advocate your org does as SRE things that your team is probably already doing. The error budget policy shouldn't be a punishment. It should be something that improves the reliability of your system. It's not necessarily the thing that would have saved you. If you knew the thing that would have saved you before the incident, come talk to me about your DeLorean. One of the reasons why, and this goes back to David's question earlier, reasons why this would fail in an organization is when an organization it just sees push freezes as a total anathema, as a punishment. We believe that this shouldn't be a punishment. It shouldn't be something that's punitive. It's got to be something that helps the reliability of the system. And what works for Google isn't necessarily what works for another organization.
So I have a question.
Thank you, Narayan.
So a lot of what you were talking about here requires a pretty close partnership with the dev team.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do this with open source? Is it possible?
That's an excellent question. I guess so, yes. I haven't actually considered that.
Sorry, I think this is a hard open question. Like, I'm just sort of curious. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but...
No, I confess I haven't actually worked with a dev team who has... an SRE team who has been SREing open source software. Apart from, like... apart from MySQL and Postgres, but that's kind of like the operating model there is very removed from the actual software that they're running, and it's the operating model which requires more SRE.
Well, so my SRE team does this, but we...
What challenges do you face?
Well, so this is the thing, right? I think that when you can treat it as a black box, and that's not the component that you need to freeze, and your sort of QA process is good enough, everything is cool. Right? It's when you're facing deeper challenges where the problems are in the open source software, right? It's coming from inside the house. That you need to actually figure out what is the process there. And I guess, you know, one of the things that I wonder is, you know, does that require a big internal investment in terms of having devs that are working on that open source software?
Well, right?
I would assume
that if you are releasing open source software and selling it, you are investing in that. That's an assumption I'm making, though. I mean, this is the reason I'm a bit stunned here, because I've not actually worked in this model before. So, any other questions? Well, thank you very much for coming, everyone. My folks over at the Google booth have asked me to let everybody know about this quiz that we're running, because it is a raffle that is being drawn in 45 minutes. So if you want to do that quiz, you can win some prizes, including a copy of my book. I even have my signing pen if you catch me later. Thank you very much, everyone.